Hey everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast. This week is the week that I think Donald Trump may have gone from being, unchained to a little bit unhinged. Marco Rubio really went after him in a very Trump-like way. If Rubio is a robot, he has become a Rock'em Sock'em robot. He was talking about what's with his face. If he's got all this money, he should sue somebody for doing that to his face. He was talking about him wetting his pants and spray tans. All the kind of statesman-like stuff that we expect out of a presidential election. But Trump really, to a lot of people who were pretty close to him and a lot of Republican observers, seemed to really get unsettled by the Rubio attack. And that is an interesting factor because going into Super Tuesday, he looks virtually unbeatable. Every single poll that's coming out seems to show him on top. Ted Cruz has some strength in Texas, the upcoming Texas primary. Marco Rubio, again, is the perennial silver medalist in a lot of places. But the question now is this kind of attack on Trump, which has come really late in the process, going to have an impact? It certainly seems to have hit him in his psyche. The other thing that's kind of amazing is suddenly people are dumping all kinds of news stories about Donald Trump. I am completely amazed by this. You could Google Trump and come up with this stuff, but none of his Republican opponents, for whatever reason, have chosen to back up the dump truck on him until now. We've got stories out about immigrant labor building Trump Tower. The Trump University thing has blown up. These are real substantive opposition attacks on Trump. And it is just amazing to me, amazing that it has taken this long, perhaps too long. Fascinating dynamic anyway. Well, speaking of fascinating, our guest this week is Rick Tyler, who up until a short time ago was Ted Cruz's communications director. He made a bit of news, and not in a good way. He retweeted, as it turned out, an inaccurate account of a brush with Marco Rubio, in which it was inaccurately portrayed that Rubio was mocking the Bible to Ted Cruz's father. It seemed like a misdemeanor, but Tyler's tweet came at precisely the wrong time. Cruz was being accused by everybody, including Trump, of being a liar, of playing dirty tricks, and to some extent, he took the fall to arrest this narrative that Ted Cruz was running a dirty campaign, though Tyler obviously denies that to me in our interview. But more interestingly, he talks about the Trump phenomenon, and he admits what a lot of Republicans have told me privately, that he would not support Trump with much force, that he thinks most Republicans who are consider themselves mainstream conservative Republicans, including Cruz and Rubio, are going to find it really hard to consolidate around the candidate if Trump is the nominee. And he thinks a lot of the big money donors like Sheldon Adelson, somebody who Tyler has had some interactions with over the years, could also sit it out. So without further ado, here's Rick Tyler talking about Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and the apocalyptic future of the Republican Party. You have had an eventful couple of weeks, to say the least. I've had weeks like this in my career, so I can completely sympathize. You resigned from the Cruz campaign. You are, I should say to the listeners out there, you are one of the better respected Republican comms people in D.C.
You're going to ruin my reputation.
Sorry. Tell us a little bit about that, how that went down. Just get that out of the way. You retweeted a video and a captioned video that had been taken by a student at the University of Pennsylvania. Just tell folks the story and tell us what happened.
There was a news story. Of course, I had retweeted a lot of news stories about Marco Rubio and Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, and the ones about Marco Rubio and Donald Trump usually weren't particularly favorable. This was among them, and it was a video that was captured by a daily Pennsylvania reporter. It's an independent school newspaper, and they had the audio was was poor, and they had put up their own captions, and the audio had said that there was one of our staffers was sitting down actually with Senator Cruz's father, Raphael, and it was a Sunday morning. Christian had his Bible open, and Rubio came by. He was actually just walking by, and he made a remark to Christian, and the captioned audio said, you won't find a lot of answers in there. That turned out not to be true, because when I asked Christian what he had said, he said, no, he didn't say that. He says, you will find a lot of answers there. So I had posted it, and it was poor judgment to post it. And the reason it was is because it was going to be blown up as, you know, I was criticizing Marco for not being a Bible-believing Christian. I never believed that. Of course, I still believe that he is. I took it as more of Marco was being, you know, it was teasing. Anyway, it got out of hand and it blew up. It was poor judgment on my part. And because
it happened at a particular point in the campaign.
Well, it did, because one of the things about Ted Cruz is that he is a man of integrity, and he really is. And a lot of the things that we'd been accused of during the campaign, people have heard them. Like, one is we had to take down an ad because it wasn't factually true. That's not true. The campaign had never taken down any ads. There was a Super PAC ad, which is an independent, that had their ad pulled, but the Cruz campaign never had an ad pulled.
And then the big one, obviously, was the Steve King thing in Iowa, where he misinterpreted a CNN report, right?
Well, the CNN report was reported out by Chris Moody, and Chris Moody's got the story from a Carson staffer that said that he was not going to go on from Iowa directly to New Hampshire or South Carolina. The fact he was going to return home to Florida for R&R. Now, R&R is commonly known as rest and relaxation, right, even on Twitter. And that is a news story. Had Senator Cruz or any other candidate announced that they were, say, Senator Cruz was going to go back to Texas for 3 days. And in fact, Carson, it turned out to be true that Carson, right, did go to Florida. He spent a couple of days there. Then he went to Washington, D.C., and he participated in the prayer breakfast, which is where he got his start. And then he went to North Carolina. And then by Friday morning, he had gotten to New Hampshire. So everything in the CNN report was true. But even if it wasn't true, the message was that Cruz is the only conservative in the race, and casting your vote for Carson would be a wasted vote. That is a true statement. Now, the message that actually came out of the campaign.
Do you think people are generally too sensitive about this? You know, when I first started covering politics, I guess social media amplifies all this stuff. But you guys are hard-edged group.
I don't know if it's hard-edged. It's a straight-up story, okay, and which is kind of confusing to me because, like I say, if Marco Rubio had done that or Ted Cruz had done that, all of our rivals would have criticized us and the media would have piled on. Somehow with Ben Carson, though, and I'm not clear on exactly why, it was a dirty trick. It wasn't a dirty trick. Now, there were, it's a little like telephone, because what the campaign had reported was exactly what CNN had said. You just don't do that. You don't announce that you're taking a few days off after Iowa, because all of us, in fact, it was very interesting, the Cruz campaign, the Bernie Sanders campaign, and the Clinton campaign all landed in Manchester at the same time.
I was there, yes.
Right, so you saw
yes, on the tarmac.
The crush of all
of I wound up sleeping on a conveyor belt in the airport that night because all you guys took all the cars. All you big shots took all the cars. It was an unbelievable night.
Yeah, it was unbelievable because ours was the smallest plane with the smallest staff, but there was a crush of people.
But you do believe that Carson just should get out of the race at this point.
Absolutely. He's a spoiler now. He has no path to victory. He never did. In fact, in Iowa, he outperformed his polls. He didn't underperform his polls. There's no scenario in which Ben Carson was going to win Iowa, and there's no scenario now in which he's going to secure the nomination. So all he is doing is making it difficult, if not impossible, for the conservative left in the race, which is Ted Cruz, to take that 6 and 7% of the vote. I'm not sure. I'm not saying he'd get all of it, but he would get a substantial portion of that.
But to some extent, your resignation didn't necessarily reflect that individual tweet. You guys needed to halt the narrative that Ted was doing dirty tricks, right? I mean, you had to sort of stop, get that story done.
I'm not going to say that. Look, I think Ted Cruz made the right decision about me. I'm not mad at him. I'm not mad at the campaign. In fact, it's one of the greatest experiences of my life. I wouldn't trade a second of it.
Well, another big thing happened last night. Hillary Clinton, I think this is the biggest political victory of her career, bigger than New Hampshire in 08, because She was about to face a buzzsaw in Super Tuesday with Obama that year, and the field in front of her now looks really, really good. She's going to be the nominee, don't you think?
It looks that way, and especially since last night, because in 2008, Obama beat her handily in South Carolina, and so she won by 48 points last night. And so Bernie had quite a bit of momentum. He's gotten great crowds, but with the way that Democrats allocate their delegates and you have super delegates, she seems to have that part of it mastered. And last night seemed to, if she can replicate what she did there, particularly winning the black vote in South Carolina through the South, then I think she'll be unstoppable.
What does that tell you about, I think there's a certain Trump effect. I mean, it's mostly anecdotal at this point in time, but a lot of Democrats that I talk to, both professionally and sort of, you know, in audiences and stuff, seem to have gotten much more serious in the last couple of weeks as they realize that Trump seems to be poised to either take the whole thing or be very close. Do you think there is a Trump effect? Do you think Hillary Clinton is strengthened by the fact that Donald Trump is so strong right now?
And what do you mean? How so?
I think they're just scared. Liberal, it's so funny. You know, there's so much hand-wringing in the Republican Party about the Trump phenomenon. There is more raw panic among Democrats about Trump than there is among Republicans.
Well, and I think that a lot of the Trump votes, see, I think a couple things are going on, Glenn, is that like the millennial generation and perhaps even people, conservatives like me, over the years have sort of drifted away from our identity as Republicans. We've, like for me and a lot of conservatives, we say we're conservative first and we vote Republican.
Right.
That wasn't always true. It was we were party people, I was, and voted Republican. But as the Republican Party became more and more moderate and seemed to sort of disparage the conservatives, it was sort of irritating because they run around every election pretending they're conservative, but they're really not. And then we're told every time we have to elect someone who's moderate to win, and yet we've seen Bob Dole, John McCain, and Mitt Romney, who are all the moderate, that we were told were the only people who can win,
right,
consistently lose. And so we said, you know, why should we try that model again? So why not elect someone who will rally the base? And what's interesting to me is that on the Democratic side, the Democrats understand these are base elections.
Oh,
Barack,
yeah,
Obama ran a base election both times.
Oh, yeah.
And when he got out his base, he won.
2012 more. And I would say, oh, wait, it's a little disputable, but in 2012, that was their doctrine.
And then yet on the Republican side, you have the moderates and the media, frankly, telling us, no, you can't elect a conservative. You got to elect a moderate because you got to win the middle. But the truth is, Glenn, is that there's no middle left. Like, there's maybe 9% being generous in the middle. And it's the way the country is divided, not just in politics, like we don't eat at the same restaurants. We don't watch the same movies. We don't shop at the same stores. The first common store Republicans and conservatives and liberals have is number 44. I don't remember the name of the store, but
right,
like, so we don't go on the same vacations. We don't do anything the same. But most importantly, we don't consume the same media. So you can wake up as a liberal every single day and never get a conservative point of view because you don't have to listen to Rush Limbaugh. You don't have to watch people who go on Fox News.
Right.
Now, if you're a conservative, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to tune into, you know, some of the commentary,
right,
that's on MSNBC or read.
You see that constantly. I remember looking. You work with Michelle Bachmann for, mm-hmm, a while, right? I'll never forget this. We did this at Politico a couple of years ago. We took pictures of people's desks, and I just remember looking at what was on her desk. There was literally printouts from conservative websites. There was nothing. There wasn't a New York Times. There wasn't a Washington Post.
Right.
There was not a multiplicity of. And I'm not calling her out particularly because I think liberals are the same way. But I mean, isn't that horrible?
but that's the way people consume news, right? So if it's very rational. If you get up in the morning, do I want to listen to people who I disagree with and want to argue with? I guess there are some people like that.
I'll be honest with you, man.
Okay,
I am.
You're a minority, though.
Yeah, right.
Most people don't want to get up and consume news they don't agree with or think is fundamentally biased.
Right.
And so they seek out the people they agree with.
Right.
And they get their fill of opinion from people that they like to read because they tend to agree with them. That's a rational thing to do. So that's what they do. But as a consequence of that, because we don't get our news from, you know, four or five channels and one or two newspapers, we get them from all over the place. In fact, most of the people get them on their devices and they're consuming news from all different types of sources, but they tend to migrate toward the people they actually agree with.
So strategically, as you were mapping out a plan for Cruz initially, you know, because he is on Fox a lot, and you know, actually, the truth about Cruz is he's probably the most accessible Republican candidate. He really interacts.
I think he absolutely is. I think because we've We tried to hold, I think we held a gaggle almost every single day.
Hillary Clinton hasn't done one in 81 days.
Like 80-something days.
So,
and it's not good for her, actually, because, as you know, you're good with the press. It's really like practice, right? You have to do it all the time.
Hey, I was with her for 200 plus days in 2007.
And when you don't do it for 80 days, you're not going to be good at it.
No, she just doesn't want to do it. But wait, but back to what I'm fascinated by is, so why bother with the Foxes? I mean, even Fox to a certain extent is a little too broad for an audience that you're aiming for, right? I mean, how do you, when you were conceiving, let me ask this as an open-ended question, when you were conceiving your comms plan, how does that reality of kind of the talk radio and kind of the narrow cast manifest itself in terms of the way you're going to allocate the candidate's time?
Well, I think, and this is, I'm a comms director, so a lot of the strategy was not up to me, so I don't want to present as if this is my ideas, but a lot of, we probably spent, it's interesting because you say we're the most accessible to the media, and we are, yet the primetime shows on Fox would disagree with you. And the reason is because we spend an enormous amount of time, like literally just campaigning.
Right.
Going into the states, doing events, and then doing event after event after event. We would do 5 and 7 events a day.
Right.
We did 28 counties in like 28 days. And that just requires an enormous amount of organization and time and effort, and it really preempts you from doing a lot of media. Donald Trump would get up every morning and call into Morning Joe, or he would call into Fox News, and that was a different strategy.
If you were to look back in retrospect, do you think that was a better strategy?
For Donald, it probably made sense because he had such a high name ID, and he had captured sort of the imagination of people in this country who are really getting hammered.
Right.
And who are not engaged politically. Like they kind of checked out.
Right.
They said politicians are a crummy lot, they're corrupt, and they're driving our country into bankruptcy, and I'm paying the price for it. I'm not getting, my wages haven't gone up, my standard of living hasn't gone up, I'm working too hard, I'm not spending enough time with my family. And so they kind of attributed all of that to mismanagement of Washington. Now, everybody hates Washington. That's an old story, but it literally is true. I mean, the country is, you know, almost $20 trillion in debt. People's wages haven't grown. And Donald Trump comes along, who they know is a reality star and like, and he's saying, I'm going to hammer Washington. Now, and he's an outsider.
But he's not just hammering Washington. He's hammering absolutely everybody else, too. I mean, that was the other thing. So do you think... I mean, as we're speaking here, Marco is on I can't describe other than sort of just like a jihad. Maybe that's the wrong term to use in this primary.
Remember, he said that Glenn Thrush never
I'll say or, equal time, a crusade or, you know, whatever the Jewish equivalent is. He's just really going after Trump the last couple of days, completely unrestrained. If he's a robot, he's a rock'em sock'em robot. Do you think Cruz was the first one to really challenge Trump in the debates, apart from Bush?
He did.
Do you regret not going after this guy earlier? Because defining somebody early is generally in the book, right?
I don't know I'm not going to say I regret what we've done. I think we ran a very good campaign, a really solid campaign, and a campaign based on integrity, which is why the others had come after us. Right. What bothers me is, well, two things. Let me start with Trump. Trump was not taken seriously by a lot of people, and indeed the news media, because I think he's one of the most unscrutinized frontrunners. He's been the frontrunner since July, and only recently are a lot of these these stories coming out. You know, what really happened with his 4 bankruptcies, what really happened with his casino parking lot eminent domain case.
Construction of Trump Tower with the use of immigrant labor. Yep.
Right. And, you know, Mar-a-Lago, which is apparently staffed by mostly foreign workers. Right. It just goes on and on and on. Trump University, Trump Network was another one where if you watch Donald Trump actually present to the Trump Network, it's a stadium full of thousands of people, And if you listen to what he's saying, it's like his stump speech, except this is long before he ran for president. Right. He was selling Trump Network. And what he's doing is he's promising prosperity for everybody. It's going to be great. We'll have the best people, the best products, all the same stuff.
Right.
And yet Trump Network failed, and he was left, you know, he left all those people holding the bag. They didn't, you know, they made an investment. They didn't get anything out of it. Trump University, people made an investment.
Yeah, but you
didn't
guys,
get anything
hold on,
out of
but
it.
You guys, and I, this is an argument I had with Tim Miller over in Bushland. Tim was a great oppo researcher, right? Why didn't you guys just go after him early?
I'll tell you why, because campaigns work in a critical path, and you can adjust the timing, and we can argue about that. But first, they have to know your name, right? They can't vote for you if you don't know your name. Second is they have to like you. You have to develop some sort of – they got to feel like they know you in some way. And then they have to know what you stand for, like what you'll do. And then the final is the contrast phase. And if you skip around those steps, it doesn't really work. So
Trump had the luxury of being able to hit everybody hard out because he had Max name ID.
He had defined himself.
And everybody, Hillary could too with Bernie because
of course,
everybody knew who she was.
Of course. But if you are a more or less, and it's hard to say, let's take Governor Perry, yeah, for instance, longest serving governor of Texas. In Texas, Governor Perry is well known.
Right.
But among people, the general population in the United States, Governor Perry is less well-known and substantially less well-known than Donald Trump. Governor Perry took on Donald Trump from the get-go. Then it was compounded by the fact so that Donald Trump at that point wasn't really a politician. He's really a celebrity.
Right.
So imagine your favorite celebrity. I don't, what's your favorite celebrity?
Lemmy of Motorhead, but he just died.
Oh, well, that's sad. I won't use him as an example then.
But Louis C.K.
Okay, so if you have one celebrity who takes on another celebrity,
right,
that's really a kind of a dumb move, right?
Right.
Because the fans of one celebrity aren't going to suddenly switch over and
right.
say, oh yeah, I really like the other celebrity better because of what that thing that she just attacked her with, you know.
Right. But they might like the fight.
Well,
they may be entertained.
Yeah, but what do they do? They hunker down with their celebrity,
right?
And they stay there,
right?
And that was the phenomenon with Trump. So if you attack Trump, his fan base. I mean, remember, he calls them fans.
Right.
He doesn't say they're supporters.
Right.
He didn't call them voters. He calls them fans. You know, so when you attack Trump, his fans rally to him because, hey, he's our guy.
Let me challenge you on that a little bit, though. He's a real disruptor. I mean, like, he is a classic disruptor, right? He has changed the rules of this game.
Yeah. Or none of the rules apply to him in the way they would apply to others. Because you know why? Because
but didn't that necessitate you guys deviating from your plan a little bit? This guy, let me give you an example. I remember in 2012, and it's a much different election, talking to David Axelrod, who was senior advisor to President Obama, and their whole thing was defining Mitt Romney before Mitt Romney was able to put on his shoes, right?
Because he was undefined.
Right.
It's much harder to do that with someone who's already defined and has defined himself. And here's the unique thing about Trump also.
Yeah.
Trump is living out his brand. Right? People know what he is. They know what they expect from him. So he says outlandishly crazy things.
But he's got a permission structure.
But he's inoculated because we expect him to say crazy outlandish things. In fact, that's why a lot of people like him.
Okay, but how do you get... Okay,
but if somebody like Marco Rubio does that, so Marco Rubio in the last 48 hours accused Donald Trump of wetting his pants.
Spray tan.
wetting
his pants while putting on the spray tan.
That's only going to serve to diminish Marco Rubio.
You think so?
Oh, yes. He doesn't have a fan base.
Do you think it's good for Ted that Marco's doing this?
Yeah,
or is it just bad for business in general?
I just wouldn't like to see Ted do something like that because I just think it diminishes and demeans the whole process.
I'm sorry, Rick. I got to tell you.
So are we running for class president of the sixth grade, or are we running for president of the United States?
I totally agree with you, but look at these debates. You know, I guess people are entertained by them. The ratings, by the way, are plummeting on these debates because I think people are sick of this crap, okay? I don't think it, and I do actually think this is ultimately what's going to put an expiration date on Trump on some level, is that it's just gross, right? It's silly, you know?
It's crass. It's non-substantive. he doesn't half the time know what he's talking about. Like, he was asked about dreamers, and he went off about American dream. Like, he didn't understand.
He doesn't understand the difference.
He doesn't know what a dreamer
is. When you're talking about Scalia, he doesn't understand the difference between the legislative branch and the Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, it goes on and on where he doesn't understand the process that he's in, but he somehow gets away with it.
Does that drive Ted? That must drive Ted, who has argued before the Supreme Court. Does that drive him nuts?
I don't know if it drives Ted. I know it drives me a little nuts because, you know, a lot of us have studied civics and government and politics, and here comes a guy who seems to know very little bit about any of them, and is driving the whole process. And yet none of the rules that, you know, that we all understand that politics is guided by seem to apply to him. And for the reasons I just explained.
But as a conservative, let me pose it this way. You know, Ted's philosophy is about a diminished role for government, right? It is. It's about sort of the tyranny of the overextension of government on a cross section of rights for folks, Second Amendment rights, but also First Amendment rights. To some extent, isn't Trump the natural, if somewhat grotesque, extension of the philosophy that the Ted Cruzes of the world have espoused, insofar as you're talking about a contempt for the way government has been conducted?
Yeah, but I think it's opportunistic, right? Because if you look at what Trump has said in the past, and he doesn't have a record on any of the things he claims now that he supports. So let's take the Second Amendment, for instance.
Right.
Donald Trump has been very complimentary and loved Governor Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of, former mayor of New York City. And Michael Bloomberg is the leading advocate of gun control.
Play golf with him.
Right. So if you know, I mean, if you care about gun rights, having Donald Trump be aligned with Michael Bloomberg would be an anathema. It would be offensive to you. And yet he now says, you know, I'm going to, and he has been quoted as saying, I don't like guns. He has been quoted as saying, I support the assault ban's weapon,
right.
Weapons ban. And that's true on abortion, partial birth abortion, gays in the military, homosexual marriage. You know, he's supported TARP. He supported bail. I mean, it's on and on and on. And I mean, this guy has a contradictory statement for everything he now proclaims and professes to be.
Well, I won't keep being a broken record on this, but again, let me throw one more log on the fire here. You have just described a devastating attack against an extremely vulnerable candidate, right? This is a guy
one would think.
Right. And now we're starting to get barraged with this fact with like this, you know, the clip file has suddenly opened up, like people couldn't have Googled it. You know, that's the thing that's amazing to me. There's actually less opacity to all this stuff because it's all out there anyway. Most everybody knows.
But if you look at the support that Donald Trump's getting, so like a lot of his supporters are pro-choice. A lot of his supporters are raising the minimum wage, even though we know what the minimum wage does. It leads to job losses and particularly hurts the low-wage workers, particularly in the minority communities. We know that. That's empirical fact. You can look at the data and see that. But yet a lot of his supporters support that. So he's attracting a lot of people into his support fan base, if you will, who aren't the Republican Party. And I think the Republican Party, as I said before, has so they're decidedly not conservative. So people like me who are conservative, you know, we vote Republican, but we don't want to leave the Republican Party. We want the Republican Party actually represent us, to be more conservative. And so we don't identify with the party as much. And I think there are a lot of people like that. And there are a lot of people who've just been driven out of the two-party system. They just don't like the two-party system.
So let's get back to your role as a core Republican. Ted signed a pledge saying he would support the nominee.
Yep.
So I have two questions on this one. First of all, you didn't sign any pledge saying you'd support the nominee, right? I mean, would you, if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, would you personally lift a finger to help him out?
Yeah, I'll say it this way, sort of, and this is so I'll give you my emotional reaction. Yeah. Like, you're asking me that today in late February.
Yep.
My answer would be no. However, I think by November, if Trump were the nominee, my answer would more than likely be yes. That's the rational.
Why? Just side. As an alternative to Clinton?
Yeah, because he would be the Republican Party nominee. And I think we can talk about third parties. There's been 1,000 of them that have come and gone. And if we want to change the Republican Party, we don't leave the party. We fix the party.
Do you think he would win? I mean, or do you think he would be an extremely vulnerable of the alternatives that are currently on the table?
I think that Hillary Clinton, who will who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, will hammer him and expose him for what he is and has, and that so far the race that the Republican Party, the Republican candidates have been fairly unsuccessful in supporting them. So she's got, she would be the nominee, and it would be a two-person race. And my, if I had the bet, I would say that Hillary Clinton would beat Donald Trump.
Pretty, I mean, Plouffe threw out some numbers. He would think that Trump in a Hillary race, and now granted he's got skin in the game, that Trump would be in the 41 to 42%, that it would not necessarily be close.
I hate predictions.
I love
because,
them.
Well, the problem with predictions is, you know, this is all dynamic. You don't know what's going to happen.
In terms of news stories with her, with the emails.
Yeah, but she could be indicted next week. I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. People, you know, if you look at her foreign policy, the Libya policy, Benghazi, her emails. I mean, she's kind of,
there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff. She also represents the past.
You do believe that in terms of...
I mean, the Democratic right. Party got over the Clintons when they elected Obama. Now it seems they want to go back to the Clintons.
Yeah, but
I find that remarkable.
Well, the whole thing, I mean, come on. I mean, the whole Bush-Clinton dynamic at the beginning of this was unbelievable to begin with. And it really, in retrospect, you
realize...
Yeah,
but look what happened to our party. Right. I mean, what happened to Bush? I mean, he raised the most amount of money, had the largest name ID coming out of the gate, and yet he couldn't get out of the single digits with all the money, with all the help, with...
It's amazing.
The whole establishment behind us. Our party said, we're moving on. The Democratic Party is going back. I find that really astonishing. And just take Clinton out of the race. I mean, who would have been? There was nobody. I mean,
it was
like
bench. No.
It was like Clinton drop off.
Well, what's fascinating about this? And I'll ask you a couple more questions, and then I'll let you go. What's fascinating about this is this race, whatever you want to say, represents kind of a flushing out of the system in both parties. Because I think there's like, particularly on the Democratic side, the bench is non-existent. On the Republican side, I think whatever you guys are going through now and whatever it means for your party long term has to happen. I mean, this car wreck has been many, many years in the making. I mean, essentially, the way that I view it is in 2010, we saw the Tea Party revolt, and there was sort of a firewall between the presidential Republican Party and the congressional Republican Party. I think that firewall is gone now, and it's all kind of combining in this very combustible mix. Things are going to change for both parties at the end of this. But what I want to get back to is the Trump as a general election candidate. We're talking about, you know, it's funny, people sign pledges. How much force, the question I have is not necessarily will Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio sign on the dotted line and support him. How much real enthusiasm will people like them have for a Trump candidacy? I mean, do you feel there would be a tremendous amount of force behind it?
Not much, because, I mean, the reason I reacted, and I've admittedly reacted emotionally to it, is because, you know, Donald Trump runs around and calls Ted Cruz a liar, and yet doesn't provide it, and frankly, Marco Rubio's done that too, and yet they don't provide any evidence for what he's lied about. To my knowledge, Ted Cruz lied about nothing about their records, but because they can't defend their record, they're going to call them liars. Now, that's very personal.
Right.
So when you do that to a candidate, and then you expect their supporters to come to you. That's Mitt Romney ran a scorched earth campaign against Newt Gingrich, and Newt Gingrich people did not rally to Mitt Romney, and it cost him in the general election.
And so that same time, and it's amplified by a factor of 1,000 with Trump, right? I mean,
it's fairly unbelievable. I mean, what he will willingly say to attack, you know, another candidate.
How significant a problem is that for him in a matchup against Hillary?
It's very significant because it's the. I'm sorry to say that our party is going to engage in the politics of personal destruction. That we're going to call each other names and not talk. But it's very Alinskyite to me. You know, pick a target, freeze it, focus on it, and destroy it. You know, that seems to be how Donald Trump and now to some extent Marco Rubio has decided to run their campaigns. I think that's a bad omen for the future of the party.
So there's a bitterness now in this process do you think this is a one cycle phenomenon? Do you think it kind of burns itself out?
Oh, I don't
out?
Know. Look, it's the business is, I love politics and the business. I'm not bitter about it. I'm observing it. I think it will correct itself because people will tire of it. Because ultimately, I think people want to do what is good, what is right, and what is good and right for the country. And I don't see how embracing a guy who is insisting on turning to invective and name calling, that's somehow going to be hopeful to anybody.
Do you think there will be Republicans who actively support Hillary Clinton if Donald Trump is the nominee?
I don't know. Yeah, sure, yes, but I don't know to what extent. To what extent?
And then the other thing is, you know, you worked for a super PAC for Newt Gingrich in the last cycle that had some dealings with Sheldon Adelson, who is a huge supporter of Israel. Donald Trump has said some baffling things about Israel, saying he was neutral in the
pretty remarkable.
Which would normally, you know, like in a normal year, would knock someone right out of the box, right?
It's another example that he doesn't know what he's talking about. He has no depth of knowledge or experience of Israel, what they faced on a daily basis. So the idea of being neutral is just preposterous.
Well, do you think Hillary Clinton has had, you can argue what you want about Obama's policy, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton had good relationships in Israel, certainly better than Obama has had. They've gone out of their way to sort of develop them during the campaign. Do you think the Adelson money and other sort of pro-Israel money on the conservative side would likely to sit that one out if Trump is the nominee?
I think it's certainly possible. I mean, because on the one hand, you have Donald Trump, who just doesn't seem to understand the Middle East and its problems and how to move forward with it. And then on the other hand, you have Hillary Clinton, who was for many years the Secretary of State when the whole Middle East blew up. I mean, there's nothing better about the Middle East or our foreign policy in general. We could even talk about North Korea. That all happened under her watch. And by the way, North Korea happened under her husband's watch.
Right. Gave him the, remember the Bill Clinton giving Kim Jong-un's father the Michael Jordan autographed basketball.
Yeah, and then they ended up with, you know, nuclear weapons because of the deal that President Clinton had struck with the North Koreans, negotiated precisely by the same person who just negotiated the Iran deal.
We're talking about Wendy Sherman, I guess. So one last question, since we're talking about the apocalypse. That's a nice dismount.
You know, it's interesting that they just say that because, like, all the movies that have come out during the Obama administration somehow surround this theme of the apocalypse now.
Don't you hate...
Why do you think that is?
Well, don't you... No, but don't you... You go to the movie... Look, I've got twin 12-and-a-half-year-old boys. Every trailer...
Oh, they love these movies.
No, every trailer is like blowing up New York, blowing up San Francisco.
Right, right.
It's like, can I just get a cup of coffee?
No, it's all post... It's post...
Post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, it's all post-apocalyptic. I call it post-obamalyptic. But
well, I mean, it explains Trump.
He must have inspired all these movies.
It explains Trump to some degree. Okay, but here's a really apocalyptic question about your own party. If Trump is the nominee... are we talking about a potential historical realignment of the Republican Party? I mean, do you think in general, even if Trump isn't the nominee, that there is a possibility that the cards need to be reshuffled? It just doesn't seem to me like this is a stable situation.
No, it's not. In fact, in the last cycle, you know, we went through the whole... Let me start with the conservatives elected a Republican majority in the House. They got nothing. Then they were told, well, if we just get the Senate, then they got the Senate. Nothing happened. And then they said, well, if we just get the presidency, they just don't believe them anymore. And so the party, the Republican Party, which is having an identity crisis, doesn't know where it stands, what it believes, what it's for, how to articulate it, how to defend conservative values, which are by and large the values of most Americans anyway, common sense values. And they created a world in which Donald Trump could effectively hijack the party. It's really remarkable. It speaks to the weakness of the ideological underpinnings of the Republican Party. And until someone comes back and can articulate what those are and get people to adhere to a common vision about what the party is and where it's going and how it's better, how it would have better solutions for jobs, the economy, the military, safety, foreign policy, it's just going to flounder. When Trump first got into the race and was leading, we discovered that only 4% of those people would actually come to Ted Cruz.
Really?
And it was actually stratified, like they were all over the place. And what that told you was they didn't know actually the names of anybody else who was in the race.
Right.
Other than Donald Trump.
Interesting.
But as time went on, those numbers got higher and higher and higher because people educated. Ted Cruz is the most Googled candidate in the first debate because people said, oh, I don't know. They said, I don't know who that is. I like what he's saying, so let me go find out about him. Now that they found out about him, you can see 40, 50, and 60% numbers in some states of people who said if Donald Trump wasn't in the race, they would go with Cruz. The Rubio's problem is if he actually, if Ted Cruz actually got out of the race, those people go to Donald Trump. They don't go to Marco Rubio,
right.
Most of them. But if Rubio got out of the race, they don't go to Donald Trump. They actually go to they're more likely go to Ted Cruz. So if you want to beat Donald Trump, there's really only one way to do it.
Right.
Is the party would have to consolidate around Ted Cruz, and even then, it could be very difficult.
Okay, one last question. We're on the
this is your third and one last.
I'm
question.
Sorry. I'll do four. Okay. we're on the precipice. Sue me, like Donald Trump. We're on the precipice of Super Tuesday. Trump's got big numbers up.
How do I know you actually work here at Politico?
You don't actually. I will show you my badge, and I have the hat. Okay, so we're on the precipice of Super Tuesday. Trump's numbers are pretty big. Cruz looks fairly strong in Texas. Going to be a bit of a dogfight on that. Is there a path for Ted or any other candidate not named Trump?
Yeah, it's narrow. If Ted wins Texas and wins some substantial portion of their delegates, he will have amassed some delegates. He will have then had two wins. If Rubio doesn't win any on Tuesday and then goes on to lose his home state of Florida, which right now he would.
Game over.
It should be game over for him. And then maybe there's an outside chance we get a consolidation around Ted Cruz and he could either accumulate enough delegates to the convention, get to the convention, or at least stop Trump from accumulating enough delegates to get to the convention.
And then you got the brokered deal.
And I have no idea how that would come
That will out. Be, can I tell you something? That will be my dream summer. Well,
it would be, that would be exciting, but I hope it doesn't happen. I mean, I hope that that Cruz is able to slow down and then stop Donald Trump and get the delegates, but if it were a brokered convention, that would be historic.
It would. Rick Tyler, thank you so much for taking the time.
Appreciate it.
It was really illuminating, and I guess we're going to find out in a couple of days.